Hello and welcome to Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb, and each week I get to share the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. As always, your feedback is really important, so if you can leave positive ratings and reviews, it's greatly appreciated. And if you want to get in touch directly, you can email hello@somersetstories.com. My guest this week is the Chief Executive Officer for the Somerset Wildlife Trust, Georgia Stokes. The Trust is focused on restoring and protecting habitats to support a wide range of wildlife in the county and build up natural processes that are essential for our environment. Growing up in South Somerset, Georgia has spent her career working for leading charitable organisations, including Amnesty International and Oxfam, as well as heading up the Wildlife Trust for Birmingham and the Black Country. She returned to her home county a few years ago and is leading the Trust through challenging times, preparing to launch a new strategy for the area in coming months. Georgia, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be with you.
Did you have a chance to enjoy any snow over the weekend? Did you get snow where you were?
Sadly, we didn't get any snow at all. Well, we got a few flakes, and my youngest son seems to have taken it as a personal affront that he's not been able to go out and build snowmen. So we're hoping we might still get some, but no, not yet.
Well, the winter is far from over.
This is true.
Are you a winter person? Do you like the winter season?
I am not. No, my children call me a reptile. I am warm-blooded, cold-blooded, and I need the heat. So no. But I do like crispy, frosty mornings when there's winter sun in the sky. It does make you more cheerful than when it's all grey and miserable.
You're over in Martock. How long have you been based there?
We moved to Martock in July 2019, so I guess about a year and a half, although we have spent obviously the majority of it in lockdown. But that's given us a great opportunity to get out and explore all the footpaths and lovely countryside around us, which my son and I have gone for a walk practically every day since March, which has been great.
Great. We'll talk a bit more about this later, but when it came to be time for you to move back to Somerset, did you have any ties to that particular part of the county?
Very loose ties. My mum's best friend actually lives in Martock, and I was staying with her for a while because I was actually still living in Birmingham and working for Somerset Wildlife Trust for a few months whilst we sold the house and brought the family down to Somerset. So yes, loosely, it was kind of coincidental that we ended up moving to Martock, but also I guess a kind of quirk of circumstance. The house that we were going to buy fell through and we needed to buy a new house or find a new house quickly. And obviously being based in Martock, it meant that visiting houses in Martock was a lot easier. So that was a benefit, but no family ties as such.
It's got some lovely old buildings in it though, hasn't it? There's an old sort of market bit in the middle.
There is, yes, and the church is fantastic as well. It's such a wonderful build to as you come in from one direction. So it's a lovely place to live. I'm really, really glad we've moved here, but I do look forward to being able to get out and actually meet some people in the future.
You grew up in Somerset.
I did.
As well, but not in Martock.
No, in Wincanton.
Wonderful town. Did you see it was in the Sunday Times this weekend?
I didn't know. I missed that.
Yeah, apparently it is the new non-fashionable, fashionable place to live.
Oh.
Which wow. I'm excited by, having lived there myself. I think it's a great, great spot.
Definitely changed a lot since I grew up there. I did it a couple of months before lockdown. And it was delighted to see a shop where you don't need any plastics. I can't think what the word is, but where you could take your own Tupperware and things. And that was a great, great find, I thought. And then, a few more coffee shops and things. Mm-hmm. Not quite as many pubs as there were when I grew up. Lots of pubs being turned into housing and things now.
Yeah. Well, the house we lived in there, not recently, but was a pub sort of 200 years ago.
So my mum used to do some history tours and things around Wincanton. And I think there was a pub on the high street called the Greyhound, if memory serves correctly.
Yes.
And King Victoria was supposed to have stayed there.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's still got the plaque.
Yes.
Which is great. So in Wincanton, surrounded by some beautiful nature, some beautiful kind of rural settings as well, did you have kind of an outdoorsy childhood?
I did. When I look back on it now, it does feel a bit sort of Famous Five idyllic childhood. I'm sure it can't have been quite how I remember it. But yes, my mum in particular used to take us out for long, long days out on the bikes or walking. And we would literally pack sandwiches and a bottle of lemonade and go off and spend the whole day out. I definitely remember fishing for minnows in the Kale. And also my mum grew up in Bruton, and we used to go for lots of long walks around Bruton, around Lady Wells and the Dovecot, and visit my nan and go up to King Alfred's Tower and Sturton and all around Brougham. So those are sort of my childhood haunts that I remember very fondly.
Were you encouraged to explore nature, to explore wildlife?
Yes, certainly from my mum and my nan. My nan could name lots of the wildflowers, so she sort of taught me to appreciate what we could see. My mum has always loved being outdoors. She's a very keen gardener and knows the Latin names of many plants. I have not picked that up, but very appreciative of it. So yeah, definitely. My mum, it comes from my mum and my nan, I think, and we spent long summers just outside exploring, going off for walks.
What kind of student were you at school?
At school, I was quiet and keen. I liked school. I did well. I enjoyed learning, but didn't have a huge amount of confidence, I wouldn't have said. But yes, I enjoyed school. One of the few people probably that can say that, both primary and secondary. Secondary had my mum teaching at the school as well, which brought amusement and embarrassment. But yes, I quite enjoyed going to school, really. I still enjoy learning.
Did she ever have to tell you off in the corridor?
She didn't have to tell me off, but she did rather enjoy embarrassing me by calling me pet names and things that in very busy corridors over lunch break. And she was the drama teacher as well, so it did require her to come out on stage on many occasions, where as a teenager you just want to sort of hide, really. Most notably when she was promoting Dracula Spectacular and came out dressed as a vampire and proceeded to approach me and my best friend in the full school assembly, pick my best friend out of the audience and bite her neck in great dramatic style. Yeah, it took me a while to speak to her again after that, I have to say. So yeah, lots of fun with my mum as the drama teacher, but it did also mean you couldn't really get away with anything because all the teachers knew me and my sister, where we were, and reported back if we did step a foot out of line.
So it wasn't a case of kind of around the dinner table her asking how was your day, because she already knew.
Yes, it was more where did you go, why were you talking to that person. Yeah.
What did your careers report suggest that you did when you grew up?
Two things, I think, that came up. This is what I remember, whether this is right or not, because sadly it's quite a long time ago now. Librarian or horse rider, I think. Both quite random.
Did you ride horses at the time?
No.
Right.
I liked horses. I think I went through a phase of wanting a horse. I did have horse riding lessons, but not regularly. I certainly wasn't at the stables every weekend or anything. So
yeah,
that always felt a bit random.
I think there are a few answers in that test, which is just, yeah, quite random. And not really well thought through, because it is just kind of an algorithm, isn't it, really? It's not someone at the end of the day being like, horse rider, that's a good idea.
Yes, it certainly didn't give me any pointers really as to where to go next for GCSEs or A-levels, or for what I might want to do when I grow up. Still waiting for that.
Oh, growing up.
Or knowing what I want to be when I grow up.
You left Somerset to go to university in London, and at the time it was the peak Cool Britannia era, the middle of a musical, cultural, economic revival. Reaching adulthood at that time and moving from the countryside to London Did you feel the impact of what was happening around you? Was there a big shock moving from Wincanton to the Big Smoke?
I did. I had a stepping stone, I guess, if you like. So I actually took a gap year and went off to Israel and worked on a kibbutz for 6 months and then did a bit of travelling around the Middle East. So it wasn't straight from Wincanton to London. I think I learned a lot about myself on my gap year and just how naive I really was with the world before I left. But yes, I definitely have memories of being in London and going on the student grants, not loans march, going to see lots of bands. I remember seeing a band on the day that the Tony Blair Labour government were elected and everybody being in a very jubilant and celebratory mood. There was an air of change, I guess, that it felt like at the time. I can't say I was the most sort of politically conscious student at the time, sort of fringe rather than right in the midst of it, but increased, I guess, as I got a bit older.
You were at King's College London, which is viewed probably by corporate employers, by, you know, FTSE 100 companies, as a hotbed of talent, future lawyers, consultants, executives. Was that type of future ever on the table for you?
I wasn't really joking when I said I never knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. I never did. So I toyed with, could I be a lawyer? And the thing that always stuck in my mind was, well, then I'd have to speak in front of lots of people if I went to court. And the idea absolutely terrified me. The same with teaching, actually. I just couldn't envisage myself standing up in front of a classroom of 30 children and having them listen to me. I couldn't imagine I'd say anything interesting enough. So it sort of toyed with the idea, but I never really knew what I wanted to do or what I wanted to be. The degree that I did at King's College was a fabulous degree. I wouldn't say it was the most useful for a career. It was United States and Latin American studies with Spanish. So I did at least learn a language, but I did get to have a year abroad. So I spent one half of the third year in California and the other half in Mexico, which was pretty amazing. So yeah, lots of life learning, but I did learn the degree covered history, sociology, politics, literature. I even did the history of jazz when I was in California, which was pretty amazing, and had to go out frequently to jazz bands and experience that. So it was a brilliant degree, but I can't say it had a necessary a career path that was obvious.
So you were more interested in lots of different things rather than wanting to devote yourself to a single thing at that time?
Yes, I think that is true. What I got quite involved with, though, as we progressed through the degree, because it was Latin American studies as well, and we were studying about Pinochet, and about the junta in Argentina and about the human rights violations, I ended up determined that I was going to work for Amnesty International. And that's where I guess I started to get more political and to recognise that we had the power to change things, but we had to push for that and we had to be involved and engage with our politicians, and I started going on marches and writing letters because we didn't have email at the time. I think it was partly through that degree, partly through, you know, my family had always discussed politics and things as well, so it wasn't purely through the degree, but that's where a lot of my interest came from, I think.
After your studies in London, you left and headed to the Midlands. What took you there?
Yeah, it wasn't a direct route there either. I did actually have a couple of fun years in Bournemouth where, I worked in bars and silver service waitressing and had a bit of fun, but also started to get involved working for charity in that I became a chugger, which is, you know, we reclaimed the term, I think. Obviously, it's quite a pejorative term, but we reclaimed it. And I was recruiting for Amnesty International. So I was continuing to be determined to work for Amnesty. I then went back to London to do a master's in human rights. And it was when I was working to support myself to do my master's in human rights by chugging for Amnesty that I met my husband, who was also a chugger. And he was from Birmingham. So we worked in London for, I don't know, a year and a half, something like that. I finished my master's. And I think there was just one day where I went to get on the tube and so it was rush hour and there was about six that just went past and you just couldn't get on one. And I just said to him, we don't have to be here. We could go somewhere else. And I think we just decided, well, let's go to Birmingham. He had his family, his parents still live in Birmingham. We went to stay with them for a couple of weeks to think about what we might do next and stayed there for 13 years.
You mentioned about reclaiming that term, the chugger. In your experience, are there people in those roles who, are they always in it for the right reasons? Is it always the kind of altruistic charitable reasons? Or are there more sort of incentivized reasons for there to be people on the street fundraising?
I have only worked as a charity recruiter with people who are incredibly passionate about the charities that they work for, very, very knowledgeable, and often doing a lot in their own time. And it was a real privilege to work with everybody that I worked with. And, you know, it's quite a high turnover, so you get to work with quite a lot of people. It's a really, really tough job. It's probably one of the toughest I've ever done because you get ignored. Actually, that's the worst thing, is being ignored. You get shouted at, you get sworn at, but it's the being ignored so often throughout the day that you start to think, am I invisible? So it's a really, really tough job. And the people are the reason why you keep doing it, why I kept doing it. So I actually worked as a charity fundraiser on the street for 2.5 years. I never worked for a charity. Or there are agencies at the time, there were agencies. I don't know that they still exist now, but I never worked for one that paid commission. And wherever possible, we worked directly for the charity. So I worked for an agency for a little while, but then moved to working directly for charities who recognise that kind of face-to-face recruitment is absolutely essential. And we as Somerset Wildlife Trust have face-to-face recruiters now who are a crucial part of our team, who do so much to raise awareness and raise the profile of the charity and connect people with the charity, as well as obviously raising vital funds. It's different now. The recruiters that we have for Somerset Wildlife Trust have a lot of material and a stand, and they're located in one space and people come over to them. They're not trying to sort of catch people's attention as they walk past. But no, I mean, it was an incredible experience. I learned a huge amount about myself, about how to talk to people, about people in general, about how to communicate big things in a short space of time. And I learned what I was really passionate about as well, because there were a couple of charities that I found it much more difficult to recruit for because I wasn't so passionate about the issues.
Was that where the sort of natural world passion started to show itself then?
The move from human rights, which was still very much where I wanted to be, to the environment actually came when I started working for Oxfam. So I got a job as a campaigner for Oxfam in the Midlands. And yeah, that was around the time of Make Poverty History, if you remember that, mm-hmm. And the G8 summit. And did a lot of work on their education and control arms campaigns. But then they started to develop an environment campaign around climate change, recognising how devastating the impacts of climate change were already becoming, not just theoretical, on the poorest people in the world. And we've started to work on developing an environment campaign. And that's where I think it all came together, really. The human rights aspect, as well as the environment and nature aspect, which just fitted really well for me.
You spoke a little bit earlier about the idea of being a lawyer or a teacher and kind of talking in front of people being quite off-putting. By this point in your career, had you got over that? Had you realised that actually it was just having something that you were passionate about that would enable you to be more confident in talking to people?
Yeah, there's an important step in the middle. So speaking to people on the streets as a charity fundraiser was terrifying, but I learned to love it. I remember my first day very well in Christchurch, just outside Bournemouth. And I knew what the job was and I'd had all the training. And then they said, right, just go and stop someone. And I thought, I can't do this. This is the most ridiculous job in the world. How am I going to do this? It was utterly terrifying, but I learned to love it. But I was still terrified of the idea of speaking in front of a room full of people or a large group. So before I got the job with Oxfam, I got a job with a charity in Birmingham called St. Basil's, which works with young people who are facing homelessness as a corporate fundraiser. And as part of that job, I had to go and give presentations all the time. And that kind of pushed me well out of my comfort zone to go in and to go to scout groups or Sir Optimist or Rotary Club dinners or big business meetings and give presentations. And once I overcame that hurdle, I realized that it was just as a similar thing as stopping someone on the street and putting your case, but this time you have slides and materials that you can use. It's not just what you say to them. That was probably the important step in between. And now I have to do it quite often. Still get a bit nervous, and I think that's probably a good thing, isn't it? Because otherwise you get a bit complacent.
After your time at Oxfam, the next couple of things that you did in Birmingham were based on the natural environment and wildlife. Birmingham, not perhaps the first place you'd think of for a wildlife trust, but if the last 12 months has taught us anything, it's that green spaces are really crucial for our physical and mental well-being, maybe even more so in cities.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree with you more on that. And Birmingham has got some incredible natural and green spaces, and you're right, it's not necessarily the first thing that you would think of, but there are hundreds and hundreds of local wildlife sites across Birmingham and the Black Country. There are some massive parks and open spaces that are amazing sort of landscapes and full of biodiversity. And in the Black Country, of course, you've got lots of, particularly in the Black Country, there's lots of brownfield sites that are sort of were created as part of the industrial era, but are now incredible sites for nature with really unusual species that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see. I know that when I was working there, black redstarts got people very excited. They like brownfield sites, and you could see them sometimes in the Wetherspoons, apparently, on Broad Street in Birmingham. I never saw them there, but apparently you could. So yeah, there's lots of amazing nature in our cities, all over the country, I'm sure, but certainly in Birmingham. And it's really important that we protect those, because as you were saying, we've recognised just how important nature is for all of us. And I can only imagine that the people who've been in lockdown in Birmingham have really found those spaces incredibly valuable, because they haven't had the opportunity to escape out into the countryside, which we've been fortunate enough to do.
What are you proudest of from your time in Birmingham?
Well, I mean, with the Wildlife Trust of Birmingham and the Black Country, we started, so I was there for 4.5 years, I think, and we started a good few really good projects that are now going really strong while I was there. I'm very excited to see that they're in the process of building a classroom at Eco Park, which is an absolute oasis for nature in the east part of Birmingham, and that will enable them to work a lot more with schools and provide opportunities for people to come a bit further afield. It's an area of Birmingham where there's really not a lot of green space or natural environment. So I'm really excited to see that that's continuing. Yeah, lots of things with the Wildlife Trust there, really. But also with Northfield Eco Centre. I don't know if you picked up on Northfield Eco Centre. I went there from Oxfam. The Central England Quakers had a building in Northfield that they wanted to turn into an eco centre. They had a bit of money to support it, but they didn't know what or how to do it. So they employed me and another person, and we developed it. I became the manager, and it grew from 2 part-time people to 13 members of staff running professional services on energy advice, domestic and non-domestic, with a bike hub where people could borrow bikes to go on bike rides, but also to do bike courses, to commute to work. So it linked up with access to work schemes, because Northfield had high unemployment rates, so it enabled people to get to job interviews and jobs, and had 3 community gardens, which enabled lots of people to connect with nature. So I'm really proud of the role that I played in that. It's not just me, but very proud of the role that I played in developing that charity from scratch, really.
You mentioned earlier that you started a family in Birmingham as well. How much of that kind of idyllic childhood that you described that you had, did you want for your own children?
Very much so. That's what I wanted. So when my boys were younger, they were very much outdoor children, always climbing trees higher than I would have liked. But I always thought, well, they got up there, so I'm sure they'll be able to get down. And they did. We did lots of forest schools, as you would probably imagine, teaching them to whittle and build fires and having cocoa and marshmallows around the fires, but also looking at and learning about all the natural world that was around us, listening for the birds, learning about the trees. So yes, that's absolutely what I wanted. It was true when they were younger. They now only want to play computer games, and I can't get them outside for love nor money at the moment. But hopefully that's a phase.
When in your mind did the idea of coming home to Somerset first appear?
I think, if I'm honest, I always knew I'd come back at some point, but I didn't know when or how. But when I was at the Wildlife Trust for Birmingham and the Black Country, I met Simon Nash, who was then the chief executive of Somerset Wildlife Trust. And the good thing about Wildlife Trust is there's 46 of us. We're all independent charities, but we all work together. We have a central body, the Royal Society of Wildlife Trusts, and we do training and events together. So I met Simon on a training event, and he made a throwaway comment, which I'm sure he probably never thought about ever again. But we were asked in that training session, how long have you been in your Wildlife Trust? And he said then, I think, I've been here for about 12 years. Perhaps it's time I started to think about moving on. And I thought, I'll just keep an eye on that. So I kind of clocked it, checked out the website every so often, but you know, nothing happened for a couple of years. And then I got an email through from our sort of central body one day saying that he decided to retire and go off and do new things. So I phoned my husband and went, I'm going to apply for this job. And he said, go for it. So I wasn't looking for a job at all. I was perfectly happy where I was with the Birmingham Black Country Wildlife Trust. But it came up and I had to go for it.
You obviously had that life, friends, children at school, connections in the Midlands. Was it really an easy decision to make?
Yes. It was, and I can't really explain why it was. I was really happy to be going home, I suppose. My husband was really happy too. We had talked about moving to the countryside on a number of occasions, never actively pursued it, but we'd just sort of talked about it every so often, or we'd sort of go through a beautiful idyllic village, maybe in Hereford or something, go, maybe we should move here, sort of throwaway comments. When I phoned him that day receiving the email and said, I've got to go for it, and he just said, do it, we never looked back, really. It just felt like the right thing to do.
To begin with, you explained that you were sort of doing the job here, but also not moving here fully. What was that time like, and how was it kind of reconnecting with your, you know, with your childhood home, I suppose?
Yeah, it was obviously quite a strange time. So I'd come down either very late Sunday night, very early Monday morning, and then go back. I think I worked from home on Friday, so I'd go back Thursday night. Obviously felt quite disconnected from the boys, but also ended up having evenings to myself, which is not something that's common when you have young children, as I'm sure you're well aware. So that was quite strange, but quite nice. Spent lots of time talking with my mum's friend who I was staying with, and when I could get out and about. It was the summer, well, April, so it was quite nice weather. So I sort of did go for a few walks in the evening, go to a few childhood haunts and have a little look round. It was a strange time. But I was really pleased to be moving back to Somerset. I sort of a strange connection, I suppose, an emotional one rather than an intelligence one. Just really pleased to be coming back and glad that I was able to bring my children down. And I have forced them. I say that they don't like going out in nature and they only want to play computer games, which is true. But before lockdown, I did force them and to do some of the walks that I had done. So they are now very familiar with Bruton and some parts of Wincanton and some other places that, I loved visiting, as well as obviously taking them to Somerset Wildlife Trust Nature Reserves.
So as CEO, what would a typical pre-pandemic week look like?
When I first joined Somerset Wildlife Trust, obviously quite a few meetings with getting to know the staff. We've got about 50 staff, so need to get to know them and the trustees and then all the partners that the trust works with, the councils, Natural England, the Environment Agency, RSPB, all those big partners. And then getting to know wherever I could, some of our volunteers and the amazing volunteer groups that we have. And I still haven't got around to all of them because we've obviously had to seriously curtail volunteering during lockdown, or stop it as it is at the moment. So there's still lots of volunteers I haven't met yet, which I will get out to meet them one day. So lots and lots of meetings, more spreadsheets than you'd think being CEO, I have to say. Lots of spreadsheets, financial spreadsheets and planning, that kind of thing. But what we started doing almost immediately is consulting on a new strategy for Somerset Wildlife Trust, because the current strategy was about to come to an end, and my trustees obviously had let me know that that was one of the key things that I was to do when I joined. And we decided that we would actually go out for a big public consultation rather than sort of refresh the existing strategy. So we did, and that was really interesting. It was brilliant to hear from members, supporters, volunteers, staff, trustees themselves, of course, and people who didn't necessarily have so much of a connection with the trust, to hear about what they think our priorities should be and how they feel about the natural world. And that's really shaped the strategy that we are about to launch. So I'm just finalising the draft today. It's taken an extremely long time because coronavirus got in the way, and we had to delay it. But yes, our Wilder Somerset 2030 strategy will be launched, hopefully, around Easter time.
Without giving the game away too much, what can you tell us? about that strategy?
Yes, it's not giving the game away too much because we did disclose some of it at our AGM. So yes, we at the AGM, I talked about four key aims. We've now merged two of them, so there's three key aims. So it's looking at 2030. It's called Wilder Somerset, and it's in line with some of the other Wildlife Trust strategies. So it's really thinking about how do we up our game, because nature is in decline and the climate emergency is upon us. The two, biodiversity loss and climate crisis, are interlinked in that they are reinforcing each other, but also the solutions to one can also support the solutions to the other, in that if you invest in nature and restore biodiversity and natural processes, you can also work towards mitigation of climate change and can store more carbon in the natural environment. So they're both really important, really interlinked. And the strategy looks at how we get more people to take positive action for nature and how we create more space for nature. And we are saying that we want nature to be in recovery everywhere, but we want at least 30% of land and sea to be protected and connected for nature, which is part of a national goal as well for the Wildlife Trusts. We have done some analysis and we can say that we think our baseline from today is 10%. So we've got to triple the amount of lands in Somerset that is protected for nature, which is quite a challenge.
We'll get on to how we might start doing that and what people can think about in a little bit. But before we talk more about the challenges and threats, what are some of your favourite things about Somerset's wildlife? What's unique about what we have in the county?
Well, we're incredibly fortunate that we've got some absolutely wonderful places with lots of different habitats and ecosystems. Obviously, the Levels is a really special place, and we've got a number of nature reserves on the Levels and Moors, in particular in the Avalon Marshes geography. So we have West Hay Heath and West Hay Moor, and our Catcot nature reserves all around the Avalon Marshes that are just incredibly special. I took my children for a walk around probably not that long ago, actually, and was treated to the sight right next to a footpath of a bittern hiding, trying to camouflage himself. I assume him, couldn't be specific on that actually, but doing his very best to sort of pretend to be a reed, but right by the footpath, which was very exciting. So the Levels are very special for all sorts of reasons. There's lots of amazing birds that you can see there, the Castle egrets, the great white egrets, and all sorts there. So yeah, it's a very special and magical place, I think. But also we've got the Mendips, of course, which are amazing. And just fabulous places to go and walk and just feel like you're on top of the world and away from everything. And we've got a coast, an amazing coast that people forget about quite a lot in Somerset. And the intertidal habitats are home to all sorts of amazing, rather small, but amazing kinds of creatures. We did a Somerset Wildlife Trust did a survey of the intertidal habitats, the first one, and found all sorts of wonderful things, and has put a story map up where you can go and have a look and see all the different species that if you go and visit, you might find. So yeah, I mean, and that's not mentioning, obviously, we've got Exmoor National Park, there's the Contocs, there's the Black Downs, the Poldens. You know, there's so many different places in Somerset that you can go and get a different experience of the natural world. It's just an incredible county, really, but it could be so much better. So it's amazing what we've got, but that's because we've had people protecting it with nature reserves and lots of conservation action. And it could and should be so much better, and we need to up our game to make it better for nature and better for people as a result.
You mentioned the bittern earlier, which has, I feel, become sort of an emblem of that kind of rewilding and, you know, the effort that needs to be put in to maintain and increase that biodiversity. Because not so long ago, they were sort of almost extinct in the area, weren't they?
They were. And I'll get this figure wrong now. I think there's 44 breeding pairs or something like that that were counted at the last bittern count. So we do a bittern count twice a year, and didn't do the April one because of lockdown. But yes, it's a real success story, the bittern, absolutely. But yes, a lot of work goes into that. That you're quite right. And we can't continue to manage sites for the sake of one species. We've got to be looking at whole ecosystem recovery and restoring natural processes, which requires nature to return at a larger scale than we have at the moment, because the nature reserves that we have are fantastic, but they can't do the job on their own. They are holding on to these precious species, and it's because of them that those species do exist in Somerset. But we need to improve the wider landscape so we can let these species increase and move out into the wider landscape.
And it's not just about the kind of the headline grabbing species as well. This starts at insects and butterflies and pollinators and all those kinds of things that we need to protect as well. What, at a more basic level, can people be thinking about? Because obviously, you know, we're in the middle of winter, and people aren't necessarily thinking about what they can be doing for the wildlife around them.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's loads of things that people can do, and we will be, as part of our new strategy, trying to provide more support and guidance for people who want to get stuck in and do things. And we're saying that we want to listen to what people need. So people have amazing ideas, actually, and sometimes they just need a bit of help to get things up and running. So what is it? What role can Somerset Wildlife Trust play in supporting people and communities in getting some of their ideas off the ground? But there are loads of things that people can do. Absolutely, ecosystem health starts with soil health. So whatever you can do to protect soil health, so reducing pesticide use. We're just looking into things like neonicotinoid use in flea spray for dogs and cats, reducing that. Obviously, composting, that's a good thing to improve soil health as well. Don't use peat compost, because one of the key things in Somerset is obviously peat extraction. That is releasing all the carbon into the atmosphere and destroying some amazing habitat. So yeah, go peat free. You know, it ranges from everything, put out feed the birds, put out bird feeders, but really looking at increasing that scale to, are there spaces within your community, at your workplace, in your garden, that you can leave for nature, that you can contribute some of your land towards what we're calling the Nature Recovery Network, which we want to deliver across the whole of Somerset, a connected spaces for nature that would provide those corridors and those wider landscape for the core sites, which are the nature reserves, to allow species to travel and expand, so that we have more wildlife, more abundance of wildlife, and more diversity of wildlife in Somerset.
Last spring and early summer in particular, with lockdown happening, there was this sort of almost waking up to the natural world around us that a lot of people hadn't necessarily tuned into for a while. And there was a lot of people saying, oh, you know, you can hear the birds, you can see, you know, more bees and more butterflies. Is that something that there is an opportunity to capitalize on, that raised level awareness? I know that from a fundraising point of view, last year you've had some really, really strong initiatives as well.
Yes, absolutely. We did an emergency appeal last year, which which had an amazing response, and we're just enormously grateful to everyone who supported us in that way. And I do think you're right. I think part of that is because people have felt more connection to nature, because we haven't had the cars, you know, as many cars and things. So there's been less background noise, which has allowed people to experience and recognize the nature that is around them, which has been brilliant. I guess it's the big question is, will that last once things do start to return to whatever normal may look like? Will that last? Is it a lasting connection? And I guess it's our job to try and help make sure it is a lasting connection, actually, and to move people from having experienced nature now and hopefully valuing it to taking action to protect it. So what we're actually seeking to do with our new strategy is build a movement for people who are taking action. We're calling it Team Wilder. And we're looking to reach a social tipping point. There's quite a lot of research on kind of on those sorts of social tipping points where if you can get one in four people to take action and visibly take action, so they need to be visible champions, you can start to get that tipping point. We saw that kind of behaviour work with recycling. So when I was first at Northfield Eco Centre, people weren't recycling to the same level that they are today, and lots of people didn't think it would ever happen. And, you know, it's not the solution, but it's a part of the solution, and it's brilliant that people are doing that. And that's really what we want, is for one in four people to start visibly taking action by maybe doing something in their community, or their school, or to get farmers to work with us. And we do work with some amazing farmers already, and farmers are doing some fantastic things around regenerative farming and nature-friendly farming. So, you know, how can we help amplify that? How can we help support farmers? There's a massive opportunity there. How can we work with developers and planners where developments are going to go ahead and make sure that they are achieving the best for nature, whether the development is appropriate? Going beyond the soon to be mandatory targets for biodiversity net gain, which is probably going to be about 10%, we think. The environment bill's going back through Parliament this week, we understand. So can we go beyond that and persuade the planners and developers to go beyond that? So it's about being practical, taking practical action. It's brilliant that people have connected. It's brilliant that people value nature. How do we move people to that next step and get them to actually do something positive? Because if we are going to deal with biodiversity decline and the climate crisis, then we need everybody to be taking action.
Georgia, we're now going to play Somerset Location or Victoria Novel Character, which is the game where you have to tell me whether names that I give you are places in Somerset or characters from a Victorian novel.
That's great. Yep, I'm happy to give it a go.
Yeah? Okay, good. And I have had to go quite niche with both the locations and the characters. So hopefully this is challenging, but also entertaining for you.
I can't profess I'm going to be an expert.
So your first name is Magdalene Vanstone. Is that a place in Somerset or a character from a novel?
I'm going to go for a character.
You're right. Magdalene Vanstone is a character.
Yes!
From the novel No Name by Wilkie Collins. So one out of one.
Excellent. We can stop there.
If only. Number two is Ben Knoll.
Let's go for place.
You're right again. Ben Knoll Woods is
good.
In fact the place. So a natural space. There we go. Number three is Tertius Lydgate.
Wow. That's quite a name. If that is a character's name, I do feel sorry for Tertius. But I'm going to go with character.
You are? You're right again. Tertius Lydgate is from George Eliot's Middlemarch.
I just started rereading that last night.
Did you?
Yeah.
Well, when you get to Tertius Lydgate, you'll remember. Your next name is Elworthy Barrows.
Natural space.
It is in Somerset. You're correct. Elworthy Barrows is, I believe, between the Quantocks and Exmoor.
Never been there, but I shall go and find it now.
Number five is Hazelbury Plucknett.
That is a place.
It is a place. You said that with confidence, like you'd been there.
I know that name. Maybe I've just seen it on a sign. I don't know. Definitely know it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is on signs. That is definitely one of the ones which kind of, it stands out. If you drive past, you're like, oh, I should go there. It sounds like fun. Okay, so you're on 100% so far, and you've got three left.
Woohoo!
Your next name is Sydney Carton.
Character.
It is a character.
Oh!
Sydney Carton is a character from Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. So there we go. Mm-hmm. Right, two left. And you're on...
No pressure.
Yeah. Okay. Your next name is Ambrose Banwell.
Banwell, I know that as an... But where do I know it? I'm going to go with a character.
You are right again. It's another Wilkie Collins novel called The Black Robe. Ambrose Banwell, I believe, is a cleric in it. I think.
Right. I haven't read that one. I do like Wilkie Collins, though, so I'll read that one.
All right, last one for a clean sweep.
Okay.
George, your last name is Hilfarence Brook.
Place.
You are correct. Hilfarence Brook is the name of a little stream near Milverton, Taunton Way. So quite close to head office, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah, not ventured out there. It will be on my to-do list now.
Excellent.
When we can go further than just local, of course.
Georgie, you scored 8 out of 8. So an expert in location and literature alike.
Or just lucky.
Thank you for your time this evening. Before we go, where can people find out more about the work that you're doing with the Trust?
Our website is probably the best bet. It's somersetwildlife.org, and there's loads of information on there, and the new strategy will go up there when it's published. We're also on Facebook, Somerset Wildlife Trust, and on Twitter at SomersetWT, I think. I'm going to be in trouble now if that's wrong.
Brilliant. Georgia, thanks so much for your time. You've been a fascinating guest. It's been a delight to talk to you.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. You can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on Instagram @SomersetStories or email hello@somersetstories.com. See you next time.